The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for being with us again this week. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. So we're out of Thanksgiving. We're into, now I can say this, Fanny, either of two ways. We're kind of getting into the Christmas season, or we're in the middle of Advent. What do you prefer?
I'd say the middle of Advent.
Okay, I think that's good. We're in the middle. Jake, what do you think? We're in Advent?
I'd say so. This is a very Advent-y season.
Okay, it's very Advent. So, okay, for all of you Latin scholars out there, what does literally the word Advent mean?
I do know this, but I forgot. I read it literally last week. Now
Jake,
I forgot.
What does it mean?
It's part of the word advantageous.
No, boo. Give yourself a boo thing. Because no.
Doesn't it mean, oh my goodness, I know this. Forget it. I'm not going to.
So it comes from it comes from Latin. Okay. Two Latin words. Mm-hmm. Okay. The first word is, depending on the declension and everything, veno, which means to come.
Okay.
To come. And ad means to. Mm. So Advent is Jesus coming to Earth.
Okay.
So we get ready for the incarnation or Jesus being born into Earth. And a number of the virtues of that, probably the main virtue of Advent or the main thing we think about in Advent is hope, hope and expectation, because we're waiting, we're hoping for Jesus to come. Now, whenever we do this religious stuff, we get messed up in terms of time frame, mm-hmm. okay? Because we're waiting for Jesus to come, but he came. Okay, he's okay. going to come again. So I mean, you kind of remember you celebrate the waiting for the experience that has already happened, but mm-hmm. you want to deepen it. You want to renew it. So that's what Advent is about. So spirit of hope. Later on in the show, mm-hmm. we're going to be speaking about Mary, because Mary is one of the, I like to say, one of the big shots of Advent.
Yeah,
Mary, John the Baptist, those are the two big shots mm-hmm. who are kind of really part of it. So later on in the show, we're going to speak about Mary, because this week, and for many of you today, is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, one of the holy days of obligation. But since it's a season of hope, what we're going to speak about with our first guest in just a few moments is we're going to speak about hope for peace. And we're going to speak about the, how are things going in the world today with regard to peace? How are they going with regard to terrorism? How are they going with regard to that? And, that's what we hope for. We hope for a more peaceful world. We talk about Jesus as being the Prince of Peace, and we talk about that, but we know there's a lot going on in the world which is not so peaceful. So, Fanny, let's got a little bit of update. How are you doing on your Advent Christmas shopping?
Terrible.
Terrible.
I'm usually good with it, and I start early November, before Black Friday.
Okay.
But this year, I don't know what happened. It just passed me by.
Okay. But you got time.
Yeah, I do have a little bit of time.
You got time. Mm-hmm. So you know one of the ways I do my Christmas shopping mm-hmm. is I do my Christmas shopping year round. Like if I see something in July, which I say, oh, that'd be a great gift, I buy it.
That's actually a great idea.
And here's the other thing, though, that sometimes happens is I don't necessarily know who it's going to.
Okay.
Because I think it's a good gift. And then as it gets closer now, I say, well, I want to give this person a gift. And I say, oh, that's a good match with that person. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't always match, but then I have a gift.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. What if you can't find the person to match with? Yeah. Then do you keep it?
Well, sometimes, and then like I go through my gifts like in November to say, well, what do I got that I did?
Right.
Sometimes it gets confusing, but that's what it does. So listen, so let's go talk with our first guest. I'm delighted that our first guest is Michelle Breslauer, who is with the Institute for Economics and Peace. And I'm delighted that she has joined us here. She focuses on American programs in North America and the Americas. Michelle Breslauer, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Thanks for having me.
So, are we hopeful about peace or not so hopeful? How are you feeling these days?
I have to say it's a bit of a mixed bag. What we do see around the world has been increases in battle deaths, in terrorism over the last number of years, and generally in terms of conflict within countries, we've seen a rise. But there are some hopeful findings as well from the work that we do, and that work focuses really on measuring peace around the world. We've seen that homicide rates continue to decline around the world. They're far below their peaks in the 90s that we saw here in the United States. We see that even though battle deaths, for instance, have increased in the last 25 years, if we look at the last century, really these deaths were just 3% of all the deaths in the last century. So once we start to take a longer-term view, we can see trends that point in a more hopeful direction.
Well, okay, that's good. That's good that there. And I, you know, Michelle, what I would kind of say, I think the reality of the world is that it's kind of never as bad as the pessimists want to pretend it is. And it's never as good as the optimists like to kind of shout that it is. There's always kind of a little bit of a mixed bag of what's going on in the world. So, anyway, but Michelle, how'd you yourself get interested in kind of this area of kind of looking at some of those international issues? What piqued your interest about it?
Well, I came from a more international background. I have parents that come from different cultures. And I grew up in a multicultural society, and I was always interested in how people relate to each other and how social cohesion can be built within a community. And that really does relate to peace. It's not just about thinking about peace as the absence of war or conflicts between countries, but also, are there peaceful resolutions to conflicts at the interpersonal level as well?
Yeah, like I took the subway to come to the studio today, and sometimes you wind up with a lot of conflicts because somebody's in the doorway and somebody's pushing somebody. So, you know, well, again, we're talking about world peace and things like that, but, you know, there are these conflicts and there are these ways that kind of when we interact with each other, we might cause a lot of small battles in our daily living in the way that we interact with each other.
Absolutely. And those small battles even can have larger consequences. We have access to weapons here in the United States that also allow some of those conflicts to be much more lethal than they would be in another context. But I think really thinking about the fact that we live in a more globalized world. People need to be able to live with others and with differences, and they need to do so in a peaceful manner is becoming more and more important.
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right on that issue. I always really thought it was kind of an unsophisticated kind of cliches when, you know, the issue comes up of gun safety, gun control. Well, guns don't kill people. People kill people. I mean, the reality is that a person with a gun is more likely to kill more people than a person with a knife. So the weapon is not irrelevant to the amount of damage that can be done. It doesn't tell the whole story, but it's not irrelevant to our conversation about being more peaceful and reducing violence in our world. So, Michelle, so one of the things I'm fascinated by is that there is this global index of peace. And I always love indexes because sometimes I think when we talk about topics like this, we say, well, you know, I feel it's more peaceful, it's more calm, etc. But kind of a global index says, hey, let's look at these things and we can kind of see which way we're going if we look at a few things. So what are some of the key indices of peace that you use to say, hey, we're doing better, we're not doing as good, we're doing pretty well?
Well, at the Institute for Economics and Peace, where I work, we publish annually an index called the Global Peace Index. And this was really the first broad measure of peace in the world. And we started publishing the index 12 years ago. And it looks at 23 different indicators. And through this index, we're looking at the absence of violence or the absence of the fear of violence, both within countries and between countries. And so broadly, those indicators are falling into three areas. So we're looking at safety and security. We measure militarization, and we look at levels of ongoing conflict.
So the item that you kind of mentioned to our listeners, murders going up and down, which one of those three areas does that fall into?
That would be part of safety and security in society, the homicide rate.
Okay. So for our listeners, I know the global categories that are out there, is what are some of those like very specific things that people would say, oh, yeah, I know, homicide rate, I understand that. What are some of the specific things in those big buckets?
So I think that a lot of people don't think about the general environments that persist around levels of violence or around levels of peace. So when we're looking at the absence of violence, we also look at what are the incarceration rates? How many police are there? What's the nuclear capability? Are there diplomatic relations with neighboring countries? These are some of the areas that I think people don't necessarily think about as contributing to a more or less violent environment. But perhaps more interestingly is that we use all this data to understand, well, what are the environments that are supporting peaceful societies, not just those that are supporting an absence of violence? Because we understand that peace is the presence of something. It's not just the absence of violence. And so we do have a framework that has 8 different buckets of indicators around what supports peace and sustainable development.
Okay, so I mean, I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I'd like to know what those are, because maybe I'll buy them for Christmas presents for people. So what are some of those 8 things that kind of make the environment more peaceful?
So we have an environment with low levels of corruption, a well-functioning government, a sound business environment.
We're not doing too well on that in the United States these days, are we?
No, it is declining in the United
yeah.
States.
Yeah.
Okay. But it could be much worse.
I'm sure about that.
We also have the equitable distribution of resources, and that's much more than just income. It's also how are different resources, such as land, health, education distributed, high levels of human capital, which is youth development and education.
Okay. So those are things that I think are really, you know, I think we can grit our hairs around them. You know, if you have a more educated population, a better functioning government, that creates a much more positive environment than if those things are lacking. So, that's a good thing. Are there any like concrete indicators that you use in addition to the environmental, like soldiers killed in war and stuff like that?
Absolutely. We look at, across the Global Peace Index, 23 specific indicators that are inclusive of deaths from internal conflict, deaths from external conflict, the number of military personnel, for instance. So the data is actually quite specific, and we're able to take it back about over a decade to look at trends, but we're actually now working on an interesting new project in partnership with Oxford University, where we're going to take back as many of these indicators as we can over thousands of years to try to see what we can tell from that historical data around trends in peace.
So, all right. So we're speaking with Michelle Breschlauer, who is at the Institute for Economics and Peace, and we're talking about indicators of peace in the world. And I think Michelle is really rightly pointing out to us is that, you know, while homicide rates and while soldiers killed in war and things like that are clearly things we pay attention to, but there are a lot of environmental issues and there are things on an interpersonal level which can make our world much more peaceful or less peaceful. So, Michelle, so let me go back to my helping me. I need help with my Christmas shopping list. So here's what I want to do. So I want to buy a travel voucher for some of my relatives, and I want to send them to the three most peaceful places in the world. So according to your index, where do I buy the travel voucher to so that they're going to the most peaceful places according to your index?
Well, you can buy a travel voucher first to Iceland.
Oh,
and they
yay.
Can go see the Northern Lights.
Okay.
That would be a great place to visit. You could buy them a travel voucher to New Zealand.
Ah. Well, I don't know. I don't like them that much. That would be an expensive one.
Or how about to Austria or Portugal?
Ah, Portugal. Fanny, what do you think? Portugal?
I'd take Portugal if you want to give me a travel voucher.
If I want to give you a travel voucher?
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, those. So that's interesting. Iceland and New Zealand and Portugal. And what'd you say, Austria?
Austria.
Yeah. We could go skiing in the Alps if we went to Austria. Okay. So we got those. Now, you know, some of my relatives I really don't like. So where do I buy them the travel voucher if they really are going to a dangerous, not too peaceful place? What's at the bottom of that list of peaceful places?
Well, Syria is at the very bottom of the list.
Yeah, not so good. Okay, what else we got?
Afghanistan and South Sudan.
Oh, yeah. You know, Michelle, we've had guests on our show from not Afghanistan, but from South Sudan and Syria. And boy, those places, there's a lot going on, which doesn't make it a very safe place to live. So how do we do in the United States?
Well, the United States is 121st in the index out of 163. So we are a little below the middle of the rankings. We have gone down in recent years. And some of the things that I try to point out, especially to people here in the United States, is that we need to remember that the United States, for instance, has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. We are involved in a lot of external conflicts. We have high levels of nuclear capability, military spending and expansion. And so there are a number of factors that go into the score in the United States.
Now, would I be right in intuitively saying that you also do a global terrorism index too?
We do, and that actually, the sixth edition of that was released today.
And I would imagine there's a little bit of some inverse correlation between the peace index and the terrorist index?
Well, the terrorism index is part of the peace index because we're really looking at the absence of terrorism then, but you are correct. So the countries that have the highest impact of terrorism are going to be at the top of that index. And for those countries, we see Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Nigeria, Somalia having the highest impacts of terrorism. Mm.
So, Michelle, one of the things I like to do with guests is to kind of give you kind of towards the end of the interview, and thank you for the generosity of spending time with us today, is to make you kind of the czarina of the world. And what are the three things you would kind of put forth that we should be doing as a world in order to increase the levels of peace in countries? What would be your highest priorities?
So I think that at the top of my list, I would think about communities and how cities and communities develop. If you look at the data and we see that conflicts have moved from wars between countries in this century to internal violence and conflicts. It means that there's more opportunity for the everyday person to work with their government, to work with their justice institutions, with their police forces. Take a look at the people around you, the institutions that are most closely related to you, and see what are your levels of trust in them? How can you work with them? Get involved. So I think one thing is to focus more at the local level. Don't just look at these big, broad global trends. Another is to pay attention to peace. I think one of the key contributors that my organization has made is that we have been measuring peace. And the fact that we are measuring this annually and making it this background ticker of progress starts to bring this issue into the public attention. Peace is something that can improve. And so to that end, we should actually focus on making peace a more tangible measure of progress, not just something that seems idealistic.
That sounds great. Both of those are very, very kind of helpful in helping us to think about this. So, hey, Michelle Breslauer, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us on Just Love. You've been very generous. And thanks also for the work that you're doing in raising up peace. And I think reminding us that if we're more intentional about it in our personal lives and in our communities, well, then we kind of do those things. We should be more likely to do those things that kind of make our world a more peaceful place. So, Michelle Breslauer, thanks so much for joining us on Just Love today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Michelle Breslauer is with the Institute for Economics and Peace, and we're talking about how our world could be more peaceful. You know what? I think we'll take a break, but as we say, just love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more peaceful and it will be more just. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation. We kind of look at our world through the prism of Catholic social teaching, and we just spoke about peace and peace indexes, terrorism index, and what we need to do to to make our world more peaceful. And I'm delighted that our guest, Michelle Breslauer, spoke to us not so much about like only just like how many soldiers get killed and things like that, but the overall context, like how do we get along with one another? Do we put people in jail? How do we do that? All of those contribute to the atmosphere of the world being more peaceful and being a better place. So I'm glad we had the opportunity to do that. Let's do a little bit of news notes. I know, Fanny, I think a while ago we may have spoken about the issue that what are the requirements for people to get food stamps? But I think they just passed a law and they just kind of re-upped it. And so tell us, listeners, a little bit about that.
Sure. So Congress looks set to pass a compromise version of the Farm Bill, which would reauthorize billions to government funds to nutrition assistance and agricultural support, but strike a plan to expand work and job training requirements for food assistant programs. So the final version of the bill looks set to be approved during the current lame duck season of the 115th Congress. The Senate and the House of Representatives have both passed drafts of the bill, but negotiations on the final compromise version have been stalled in recent months. So in April, representative of some Catholic groups wrote a joint letter to the House Agricultural Committee about the bill. The letter welcomed efforts to improve state workforce training programs, but cautioned that the bill will not appear to offer sufficient investment to fund training programs.
So one of the issues that you point out, Fanny, is the fact that, you know, we have a basic kind of approach in this country, which corresponds with our Catholic social teaching that, you know, if we give somebody some assistance, if they're able to work, they should kind of be working for it. Now, and that corresponds with our Catholic social teaching that we believe that work is good and that it's part of what it means to be human and it's good. And so people should be incentivized to work. Where we sometimes draw a little bit of a distinction with public policy is, how much do you incentivize work and how much do you punish or sanction people if they don't engage in work? So that was a little bit of this debate. And sometimes, given what's going on, you can create rules that really are burdensome and they're not productive in fostering it, even though on the surface, you know, they might be there, because we do have requirements already that people who are able to work should work, that we don't just provide assistance without asking people to be trying to better themselves in whatever way they can. So I'm glad you pointed that out and that there was, you know, a modification that to make it more reasonable in the way that that program is administered. What else you got?
So in Nicaragua, Managua is the city where things are kind of getting very fearful there for the citizens. So there's a climate of fear currently in that city. Recently, the government conducted a raid at a mall and put dozens of people in prison after they had been accused by their neighbors of having participated in one of the many anti-Ortega rallies in recent months. So Ortega
is the president
right,
of the country.
Daniel Ortega is the president of Nicaragua, and Rosario Murillo is the vice president and also his wife. So the citizens say that she's
keeping it in the family.
Yeah, seriously. So citizens of Nicaragua say that she's really the one who leads the country and is responsible for the country's downfall. What's happening is that they are conducting a lot of protests, a lot of raids against people. So it's the government versus citizens down there. But the church has really been more of a safe haven for these citizens. But the government is now kind of going against the church, saying that they shouldn't be, people shouldn't be refugees at the cathedral there, et cetera, et cetera. So the church really has their hands tied in this situation.
Are there particular items or issues that the government has done that the people think are unfair, and is that what's upsetting
them? Yeah, so one of the things in the article is that they, for example, they've changed the Constitution 3 times.
Okay.
And they basically go by their own laws. It's becoming very violent. Citizens are becoming desperate. So that's why the protests are happening.
And what do the citizens, what some of the issues or items that the citizens would like changed?
Well, it's funny because they don't really want to talk that much to reporters or anything like that. They hide their identity. They actually, one of the things that I read was that so WhatsApp is very popular in these countries because it's a free app, and they even delete that app and don't talk to family members, etc., because of these things. So one big thing is the infrastructure. There was an earthquake in the 70s or 60s, and they've rebuilt these buildings, but they're still not stable enough to even be in them. So if something happens, even a hurricane, not even an earthquake, just a hurricane with a lot of wind, then there is a possible collapse of these buildings.
So so if we kind of look at this from our Catholic kind of social teaching, now there's been a government there. I think President Ortega has been there for quite a number of years, has been there. And what the people are doing is saying, hey, things got to be better. Things are not good that is there. And the church is very much kind of, you know, gotten involved and say, hey, the people should be allowed to protest. They should be allowed to express themselves. And as you mentioned, Fanny, even some of the church buildings are being used to protect people. And, you know, in the broader context, so Nicaragua is not one of the main countries that's sending or from which the unaccompanied minors are coming. That is El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, but it's right nearby.
Right.
And so when we talk about the violence in Central America, it's all part of a kind of a whole region in which there's a lot of unrest. As our previous guest says, there's political corruption. Mm-hmm. And so it's a whole part of the world in which, you know, things are not the way that they should be. And so in Nicaragua, you have people protesting, you have violence in the streets, the government back. In the other three countries, you have people fleeing so that they can be safe and have a better life. So anyway, earlier this week was the funeral of President Bush 41.
Yes.
How'd the funeral go?
So it was actually very peaceful. You know, one of the things that kind of stuck out to me was this Reuters article about the funeral arrangements. As we all know, they flew him into Washington, and he's I believe being buried in Texas.
Houston.
Houston. So they, you know, as we all know, you know, the nation basically took off as a Memorial Day on Wednesday, and both parties were present at his funeral. And this article that I read on Reuters kind of illustrated this peaceful union for the president and called it a very gentle and kinder nation that day, which I think is kind of in the topic of peace and, you know, for today is a great thing, because we haven't been seeing a lot of that in the nation so far.
Can I tell you my one President George Bush
encounter. Yeah.
So some 20 years ago or so, I was meeting with Cardinal O'Connor in his, where he lives, over on Madison Avenue. And there was a knock, the doorbell rang, didn't think much of it. But then like a minute later, in the doorway of the room where Cardinal O'Connor was meeting with me, George Bush appeared. It was 1993. So he was just out of office for maybe 3 or 4 months. And he appeared in the doorway. Now, my recollection of that is the following. He saw that Cardinal O'Connor was with me, and he instinctively took a step back. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt that you're here. Well, I stood up and I got out and Cardinal O'Connor came in, and I was in the hallway. And so about 15 minutes later, former President Bush comes out, and on his way out comes right over to me and says, I'm sorry. I interrupted your time with Cardinal O'Connor I'm sorry that I did that. Well, to me, that just speaks so much of human dignity, mm-hmm. decency, and that I was nobody. And this was the former president of the United States, envoy to China, head of the CIA. And he apologized to me for taking 15 minutes of my time with Cardinal O'Connor. And it seems to me that that is just such a story of human decency that it's something I always kind of remember. It was just a great, great story. You know, and I do think, Fanny, thank you for kind of sharing with our listeners the peacefulness of that. And I do say that in my opinion, the political world that we live in today is really not peaceful. A lot of anger, shouting, divisiveness among everybody, senators, presidents, everybody, new politicians, old politicians, whatever. And you know what I think? I think this funeral of President Bush enabled us to come together to say, you know, if you give us a shot at this, we don't like what's going on today. And that's why I think he got elevated, maybe even much more than in his lifetime, as somebody who was decent, somebody who was that. Because it's so absent today that I think that this gave us an opportunity to say what we'd like to be at without necessarily condemning what's going on today. So, you know, I'm glad we had the opportunity to do it as a nation. Gee, I really hope that it's got a little bit of lasting effect where maybe we can tone down the rhetoric, we can raise the level of decency among us. You know, the other story I heard about him, mm-hmm. and that he, you know, where he always, you know, where he always celebrated Thanksgiving when he was president. You know where?
Where is that?
Camp David.
Oh.
Which is the presidential kind of retreat.
Yeah.
Now, do you know why he celebrated it there?
No.
He celebrated it there because that was the place where the president is able to be safely protected with the least number of staff. And so he chose to go there so that the fewest possible people were away from their families on Thanksgiving. I think that's another measure.
That's very nice.
That's a measure, man. Mm-hmm. So why don't we take a break, okay? This is Just Love, our weekly conversation about the church and the world. We say just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. We're going to be speaking about Mary as we celebrate the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just Do It.
Just Love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just Do It. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. We weekly kind of look at what's going on in the world, and we try to look at it through the prism of our Catholic social teaching. Well, we're in Advent, and as we learned at the beginning, it means coming to. Jesus coming to us, the Incarnation, and that wouldn't have been exactly the same if it wasn't for Mary. Mary is the one who said yes to becoming the Mother of God, and in Advent, we celebrate her, probably her major feast, but one of her major feasts, the Immaculate Conception. So this week, we're celebrating the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And so I'm delighted that we have as our guest Vanessa Corcoran, who is at Georgetown University. And when she was writing her doctoral dissertation, she wrote on Mary and the representations of Mary in medieval art, medieval literature. I probably got that not exactly right, but Vanessa, thanks so much for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted. So tell us what the title of your doctoral dissertation was.
So my doctoral dissertation, which I wrote at Catholic University here in Washington, D.C., was called The Voice of Mary, Later Medieval Representations of Marian Communication. And the sort of impetus for this is Mary only speaks in the Bible on four occasions, which may be very surprising to a lot of your listeners. And in fact, when I share my research, it surprises the audience as well. She speaks on four occasions, three times in Luke, first at the Annunciation when the angel Gabriel appears to Mary. And she says yes and agrees to.
Well, but first she says, what's going on?
Yes. Exactly. What is the meaning of this?
Right.
And then at the Visitation, when she greets her cousin Elizabeth,
right.
Which then we also know contains both the origins of the Hail Mary prayer, but then also Mary's response, the Magnificat, is a central part of Marian devotion today. She also then speaks when she finds Jesus when he's 12 and stays behind and is lost in the temple. So she reprimands him in that case. And then the last time that she speaks, this is the only time it's not in Luke, it's in John, at the wedding at Cana. And in that instance, she appears to him and says, they have no wine. He grows frustrated at her, but she, you know, speaks to some of the workers there and says, do whatever he tells you. And so Mary's voice launches Jesus's public ministry.
So, you know, Vanessa, what I've always said about that scene in John's Gospel from Cana, mm-hmm. and this is my paraphrase of it, is, you know, Mary says to Jesus, hey, Jesus, they've run out of wine, do something. And Jesus says, hey, Mom, forget it. Not my time. I'm going away. You know, if that were my mom, the next thing would have been a pow from my mom to me saying, hey, do something there. But that's my paraphrase of John's Gospel. It's not in the Gospel, listeners. That's my take on it.
Right. Well, and to think about this idea of paraphrasing. So as I said, Mary only speaks on the Bible on four occasions. However, in the later Middle Ages, which is my field of research, there are all of these devotional sources that imagine Mary speaking much more frequently, either expansions on those four instances, but then also sort of meditations on instances such as the crucifixion. We know Mary was present at the crucifixion, but from the Bible, she doesn't say anything. And so these different theologians, mystical writers imagine these laments, and it was called in Latin the Planctus. And there are these beautiful, sorrowful, elongated expressions of mourning from Mary's voice. And so I was really interested to see what made different authors grapple with Mary's speech and what sort of conventions did they play with. And the more research I did, I started to notice also that these sources portrayed Mary in a much more powerful and authoritative way than we're accustomed to seeing. You know, usually we think of the nativity scene in which Mary is, you know, demurely leaning over the manger looking at the baby Jesus. But really, in the later Middle Ages, she was viewed as a very powerful woman. And if you look at some of the various titles associated with Mary, such as Queen of Heaven or Throne of Wisdom, these sources really enjoyed grappling with those titles and sort of, you know, looking both in visual and textual expressions of these.
So if you look at some of those things going on in the Middle Ages, was that voice that emerges there? Mm-hmm. Now, power can manifest itself in different ways. It can be good power, bad power. Mm-hmm. It can have a particular thrust. Were there any themes to the exercise of Mary's power?
Sure. You know, there are some ways where Mary is viewed as an authoritative figure in terms of scripture and education. So Mary is portrayed as the seat of wisdom or the throne of wisdom, or in another term in Latin, the Magister Apostolorum, the teacher of the apostles. Hmm. And so you have, you know, these beautiful medieval illuminations that depict all of the apostles seated around Mary, and she has a book open and she's sort of leading them. Or what's very popular, images of Mary teaching the young Jesus how to read. And this was an idea that became popular in the 12th, 13th century. You can also see this idea of Mary as a scholar really emerged during this time in Annunciation images. When you look at some images of the angel Gabriel appearing before Mary, a lot of times she has a book open. Originally, you know, early 9th, 10th century images, Mary is with, you know, sitting at a spinning wheel and is, you know, making some sort of cloth. And there's a shift, and it happens at the same time where more sources are looking at Mary as this figure of wisdom, of holy knowledge. And that's why she would be a literate figure in how they're representing her and showing her with a book. So that's just one example of one manifestation of power within education and learning.
We're speaking with Vanessa Corcoran, who is at Georgetown University, and we're speaking about the voice of Mary. You know, Vanessa, so I have a little bit of a kind of confession to make. I've always thought that Advent, if kind of we kind of put Jesus in the right place there, the two other figures that are part of the Advent scene are John the Baptist and Mary. Those mm-hmm. are the two human figures that are there. I got to confess, Vanessa, okay, if you don't tell anybody except our millions of listeners.
No one else can hear this conversation.
Right, right. I'm really a John the Baptist guy. Mm. He's the guy who, my go-to guy. I think mm-hmm. I like him. So Mary, I'd never say a bad word about Mary, but John the Baptist. So, but I would, you know, and confirm in me in this, what you've just pointed out, those notions don't seem to have made it into much into contemporary piety or spirituality surrounding Mary. Or am I just so focused on John the Baptist that I've missed that carryover from the Middle Ages?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point, Monsignor. And I think it speaks to something that really fascinates me about Mary, is that Mary means different things to different people and is probably one of the most fluid and dynamic figures in Christianity. Part of that you can just see with how many different titles and associations are, you know, come to mind when you think of her. But for different periods of time, For different groups of people, Mary means different things. And I can think of no better illustration of that than the church next to where I went to graduate school at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. And if you ever go there, you'll see all of these different chapels devoted to aspects of the Virgin Mary. So you have Our Lady of Perpetual Help. That was the chapel I always liked to go to in graduate school, praying for help with exams.
Right before exam time.
But then you have all of these geographical and regional depictions of Mary. Our Lady of China, Our Lady of Africa. And each area has come to Mary in a different way and has a particular association with her. And I find that this is what makes her so interesting and what makes her endure throughout the ages. So you have, you know, Mary reaches out to people who are struggling in a variety of ways. She's viewed as a mediatrix or a mediator. And so I think, you know, there is a point to be said about this more powerful notion of Mary that I wrote about in my dissertation, where she's depicted as Queen of Heaven and even, surprisingly, Empress of Hell, in which she has the power to reprimand sinners, to chastise the devil, and even there are these great images of her fighting the devil, clocking him on the head with a stick or with a sword.
We could make a Marvel series out of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. She's a very powerful woman and recognized for her power. And so some of the miracle stories that I looked at from the Middle Ages speak to, you know, the clear might and power of Mary and how she was viewed as this powerful figure who could intercede on behalf of supplicants. So you have people who were potentially condemned to hell who, you know, prayed to Mary for intercession. And, you know, through this sort of spiritual reckoning, Mary is able to save them. And it was surprising how frequently these both visual images and then textual stories of this happened, particularly, you know, in the 1300s and 1400s.
So listen, Vanessa, we only have a couple of minutes, but so here's my suggestion to you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I got to tell you, probably there aren't too many doctoral dissertations that make the bestseller list, right? And probably your royalties from it are not enabling you to have this private villa someplace. So, but, in light of the success of, and I haven't seen it, but somebody was talking to me about it yesterday, Handmaids.
The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah, The Handmaid's mm-hmm. Tale. I think there's a future for you if you take part of your dissertation. I think we could turn it into something. Imagine the Empress of Hell. We could, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a great, I think there's a great way to bring this to the 21st century, and maybe we'll make you a few bucks on it too. How about it? Come on.
That sounds great. And it's, you know, I think, you know, when I was doing my research and learning this, it gave me a greater appreciation for Mary's influence. I mean, she dominated the landscape and continues to dominate the landscape of Christian spirituality, and you can see it in prayers, hymns, sermons, liturgical traditions, other devotional practices, and then, of course, the imagery of Mary. You know, that is what will inform how people view Mary, because it's so memorable. It's so arresting, you know, the different depictions, particularly at this time of year, those of the Nativity and also of the Annunciation.
So, Vanessa, I'm going to have to let you go, but would you come back again? Because I'd like to learn a lot more about it.
I would love to. That would be great.
That'd be great. Vanessa Corcoran?
That's correct.
Who is at Georgetown University and who has done research on the voice of Mary in the Middle Ages. And we've been talking a little bit about this. This is our kind of prolegomena to kind of moving this into the 21st century, and maybe Marvel's going to pick it up, or somebody else. We're going to turn it into something where it kind of has a lot more shelf life than just a doctoral dissertation. Hey, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Fanny, I'm fascinated. I'm so fascinated. Can we do? What do you think? Can we do it?
Yeah, I think it's like really. I've actually never thought of her as the Empress of Hell.
Me neither. I never even knew that. I mean, and some of the other things. Like I said, I could tell you a lot more about John the Baptist because mm-hmm. I like John the Baptist. I think there's a lot to him, and kind of. I think this is a lot of good stuff that she's into, and I think. This is too valuable for our spirituality for the 21st century to leave it on the shelf. So we got to figure this out, how we're going to do this. But anyway, so happy Advent to everybody. Happy week in which we celebrate the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. We're hopeful. Hopeful that the world is more peaceful, less terroristic. And, you know, we count on Mary as somebody to intercede for us to make our world more peaceful. Thank you for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.